Welcome to Recovery Talk on AM 600 The Answer. Recovery Talk is brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. Listen today as our expert staff educates you and guides you in the areas of addictions, depression, and trauma so you can be better informed. To be a part of the program, call 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255. Now please welcome the Refuge Expert Staff Members. Once again, the Refuge Expert Staff Members.
Hello and welcome to Recovery Talk. We're here live every Sunday evening from 4 to 5. I'm Heather Muha, Professional Outreach Representative with The Refuge, a healing place, and your host for this evening's show. Thousands of kids in Florida went back to school last week, bringing with it new opportunities to become involved in sports, join clubs, and develop new friendships. But there's always a flip side that we can't ignore. The possible exposure or negative influences of tobacco, drugs, and alcohol. So whether your child is toddling through preschool, meandering through middle school, or cruising through their 20s, we're going to give you some tips to help guide them and you toward a healthy, drug-free life at every age, and any age. But first, we're going to talk about case management as it relates to drug and alcohol treatment. And joining us to do that is Mark Rosen. Mark is a case manager at The Refuge and has been for the past 6.5 years. He helps clients plan for their life after treatment by teaching them basic life skills like resume writing, budgeting for groceries, and even how to change a tire on a car. Mark is also working toward his master's in licensed mental health counseling, and he will graduate in May of next year. Mark, thanks for being with us this evening.
Hey, Heather, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
All right, so why do you think case management is important when it comes to substance use treatment?
Well, as a case manager, you have to wear many hats. Case management, we do a variety of work with clients in residential treatment. I know you touched upon a couple things. We do legal issues, disability, discharge planning. We do life skills as well. And we do speak with a therapist so we can formulate a good plan for our clients when they're being discharged from residential treatment. I think it's important to have case managers because we're able to formulate plans with our therapists, and you know we're experts in our field in what we do. By having referrals for local sober houses, understanding disability, we work with attorneys in case anybody has legal issues. We do know a lot of therapists nationally, so we're able to refer our clients to a safe place upon discharge. And I think it's also important that you mentioned resume writing, interviewing, budgeting. I think for a lot of clients that are in residential treatment, they lose these skills or they've never had these skills. And I know for a lot of addicts who come out of treatment and even addicts who aren't in treatment, having a lack of these skills, I'm not going to say that they're definitely going to relapse, but these are some things that people will relapse over. If you can imagine never being taught how to interview for a job or to write a resume, and you get sober and you're asked to go get a job. And it's a pretty frightening prospect for a lot of people coming out of treatment.
Yeah, Mark, how did you get into case management?
Case management, I am sober. I've been in recovery for 14 years now, and I was offered a job by The Refuge, which I'm really lucky and I was blessed to be offered. And I wanted to do case management because I wanted to incorporate the life skills aspect for a lot of our clients that were being discharged and needed help with things that we just previously discussed with resume writing, with learning how to interview, change a tire on a car, little everyday life skills things that, some people take for granted. I wanted to incorporate and teach these things to our clients. I also wanted to be a part of the discharge process, when it came to sober houses, because I know it's very tough to locate strong programs, good sober houses out there, and I wanted to be a part of that for our clients. I wanted to place them in places that have that had excellent programs where they could excel, you know, and hopefully succeed when they discharge from our program. And that's a very important aspect, is to have strong connections out there, people who are really genuinely want to help others and help others through recovery. And learning the legal aspect also, we've had a lot of clients that have come in, you know, with DWIs, with other legal issues as well. And that really interested me because, you know, clients come into residential treatment and they do have legal issues and they don't know how to handle them. But just, you know, simply by being there and communicating with their attorneys or the public defenders and handling their legal issues while they're in treatment and letting them focus on their own recovery, you know, they can really take a deep breath and breathe easily and go through the process knowing that there's somebody there to help them, you know, with their legal troubles.
Yeah, you're very much an advocate as well. And this is
absolutely.
This is a silly question. It might be a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How is it possible that, I mean, we, the Refuge, deals with adults, 18 and older, but to not have those skills or going through life and not know how to write a resume or budget or doing those things that you think some people might judge as saying these are everyday skills. How in the world did they even survive or function in our world today without knowing these things? What would you say to someone who asked that?
I think it's tougher in our world today to get by without, you know, knowing how to write a resume or interview for a job. I know, and I'm just going to use it as personal experience. When I was getting sober, I still had a lot of good connections from friends who would just land me jobs. You know, now everybody has to go through background checks nowadays. You know, but you know, when I was getting sober, even before I got sober, it was pretty easy to land a job. In the 90s, you know, I don't want to get into political discussion, but the job market was really, there's a lot of jobs available out there. So it was quite easy. But, you know, and I'm going to include myself in this, as, you know, addicts, we're really good at making things up. We're really good liars. We're good fibbers. So we're pretty creative people. Usually addicts are very intellectual. They're very smart. So, you know, getting by in life is not that difficult, but it does get pretty old after a while. You know, and it just depends. You know, if you have good connections out there, friends can get you jobs, you know. But, you know, the jig is up sometimes. You know, when you get sober, you have to learn these skills because you want to move hopefully towards a more, in quotes, normal lifestyle, an 8-to-5, 9-to-5 job, or you know, just have to incorporate some structure into your routine.
And an honest lifestyle, I'm assuming, too.
Yes, exactly.
An honest lifestyle
is important, yes, and that's something that we all have to learn. And, you know, a lot of addicts have had that 9-to-5 job, you know. Others have been bartenders. They haven't been employed. They've done, you know, some things that they're not proud of, and that's totally understandable. But part of the case management, you know, process is hopefully to get them back on their feet and to, you know, you always have to be real when you're dealing with clients and let them know, you know, what things are, what their future is going to look like, but what they need to work towards. And part of that, like you said, Heather, is an honest lifestyle.
And give them that hope as well. Well, Mark, thank you so much for teaching us all about case management and for everything that you do on a daily basis to help our clients.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll talk about how to talk to your kids about drugs and alcohol. Stay with us.
You're listening to Recovery Talk Live right here on AM 600, The Answer.
The Refuge, a healing place, is a leading treatment program for men and women struggling with addictions, trauma, and co-occurring issues such as depression. The Refuge is nationally renowned for working with its clients to create real, long-term recovery. With their caring staff, you begin to unravel the underlying causes of your issues and gain the strength to accept and overcome them. They take a unique trauma-aware approach to treating addiction and co-occurring issues that emphasizes holistic treatment of the mind, body, and spirit. Their safe private campus is located an hour north of Orlando in Ocala, Florida, and features residential and outpatient treatment as well as drug detox. You can call them for a free confidential consultation, 866-612-6610, or visit their website, therefuge-ahealingplace.com. Welcome back to Recovery Talk on AM 600, The Answer, brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. To be a part of the show, call now, 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255.
Welcome back to Recovery Talk. Again, I'm Heather Muha, Professional Outreach Representative at The Refuge. We're here to talk about all things recovery-related. So if you'd like to be part of the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Just call 904-222-8255. Well, it's that time of year again, back to school time for families. And I was wondering if you had a conversation, perhaps, with your young one about the dangers of tobacco, drugs, and alcohol. The work you put into opening the lines of communication with your child now can make all the difference for their future. Luckily, we have Dr. Tina Gooden here to help us navigate those very difficult discussions. Dr. Gooden is a board-certified psychologist and has treated individuals of all ages, couples, and families for over 25 years. She is currently the chief clinical officer at Artesian Wellness Center, a residential drug and alcohol treatment facility, and maintains her booming private practice in South Florida. Tina, thanks for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Heather. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, what age do you think we should begin talking to our kids about the dangers of drugs and alcohol, or even opening up that line of communication?
So I think before we talk about the age, I think we need to talk about the stage. And in my years of practice, I've come to learn that children know most everything about everything before they can speak. They see their parents, they see their family, they see the adults, and they see what's going on, and they take it all in. And so when we start to think about naming it, putting words to it, it's almost as if it's a relief because it's familiar in their little minds. So I think that when we acknowledge that there's something going on, you know, we are actually helping them relax because they've noticed something is going on, even though they couldn't name it.
And so you're talking about alcoholics in the house, correct? Or someone who is suffering with drug and alcohol addiction in the house.
Anyone that's close to them in their family that they would know of it because they've seen it. And then those who don't have it in their home and see it, let's say they visit a friend's house or they hear about something, who knows, on television, and they don't know what it is, they're curious and they're puzzling, and they need someone to come along and acknowledge that they've observed something, or have they observed something, or do they have any questions about something they've observed? Oftentimes, children walk around with accurate observations that have accuracy, and no one has come along to say, did you notice that, whether it's in their family or it's outside. And so it's never too soon to find the language to approach a child at their level, even if it's through play.
Explain that. What does that look like?
So often when I'm working with 5-year-olds or 4-year-olds and we're on the floor playing with whatever they have, and they're telling me a story about themselves through their toys or their games or their computers, and they're trying to show me something about their experience. And oftentimes they are not able to name it because they don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. But they know something's not right. So they'll have, let's say, a little girl will be playing with two dolls, and she'll have them kind of smash up against each other. And I'm wondering, well, what's going on? Well, this one's, you know, kind of not happy with that one. Well, this one, what happened? Well, this doll over here was not nice. And what did they do? They did something bad. What did they do? They did something bad. And we probe, and over time they begin to reveal that they noticed something wasn't right with somebody, and they're projecting it onto their toys. And as we continue to talk, what often emerges, they're trying to tell me something about somebody close to them, or they're trying to tell me about something they observe that doesn't feel right. It could be at school. It could be at daycare. And sometimes it turns out to be that they're trying to let me know that somebody is drinking.
Mm.
And they couldn't actually articulate it. So now we're talking about the very young child. So I make the point to say that it's never too soon.
Right, and it's not necessarily the age, but it's the stage.
Yes, it's the age together with the stage, and it's the stage. Sometimes a child isn't ready to hear something.
Now, is there any way to protect kids from exposure to drugs and alcohol? I asked that question, but I'm thinking you already answered it because you talked about TV, you talked about friends at school, or that possible family member. But I think parents really want to protect their kids from everything and maybe going down that road of using drugs and alcohol. Is there any way, just like parents vaccinate their kids against illnesses like measles, is it possible to immunize them against drug use? And if so, how do we go about doing that?
It's a good metaphor to immunize them, to vaccinate them. You know, I like to think that the best way for children to be immunized is to be surrounded with models that emulate that. And so the more that their culture and their immediate environment and then the secondary environment is free of that, and that's not always under the control of parents, because children, you know, they go to people's houses and they're at school. And so it's not always possible to be able to control all of that. However, certainly doing what we can to keep them, you know, register them for after-school activities where the people going there are, to the best of our knowledge, free of this sort of thing, or a school district, you know, will hear parents talking about moving to a particular area in particular because of the lack of problems either related to drugs or alcohol in the particular area, and they'll avoid another area for that very reason. So I think it's the modeling around them more than anything, because they are stage-wise learning to identify with their surroundings in their environment on a daily basis. So I think it's particularly important for parents to be cognizant of what really is going on at the places that they visit, and who their children are hanging out with, and who they're hearing about, and the talk that goes on quietly. The problem with that comes up when a family themselves has someone who is either in recovery or is dealing with an addiction, and they're preoccupied. And so that often leads to that, you know, restricts. It holds them back from making sure that that their children are safe. I think education is another matter. I think schools that more and more we have in our schools programs that address addictions of all kinds. So that is, you know, we used to have years ago sex education in schools. There was a time before that we didn't have it. So now we have education for addictions, and I think that's particularly important as well.
Yes, and what, I mean, there is very much a keep quiet or don't tell anyone or just act normal. I think a lot of children living in homes that have parents who don't necessarily want the general population or their neighborhood to know what goes on behind closed doors can be very difficult for a child, and they can internalize that and hoping that that parent or parents move into a program of recovery of some type and take their child with them along the way would help to, I don't know, break the cycle, if you will, children and alcoholics to learn about addiction in an age-appropriate way, just like you said. Now, say that what affects whether or not the kids test the waters? I mean, I think of teenage years. Teenagers are a little rebellious. They're going out. There's prom. Maybe one of their friends has drinks at their house or something like that. In that moment where it's a maybe, oh, I want to try it, is there something that parents can say or do to avoid, that situation or that risky behavior? Is it inevitable that kids are going to be exposed in that way? And what makes them say no or test the waters?
Such a loaded and important question, Heather.
Sorry.
You know, yeah. I mean, that's a show or two all on its own.
I know.
So, yeah, it's, you know, one of the, at a talk I gave last week, one of the observations I've made of people coming to see me over the years, that those who end up trying or doing drugs often, very often, are the most sensitive child in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may come as a surprise, or maybe it doesn't. And what I mean by that is they're often the people pleaser. They're often the shy one. They're often the one that feels left out. They're the one that hurts the quickest, the soonest, that gets it. They're the one that wants to be there for somebody else. They're the one that wants to be loved. Now, we can say, well, all children want, you know, all of that. However, there are differences in families. And the weakest link in the family, and what I mean by the weakest link, I mean the most vulnerable link, is that child. Vulnerable in the sense that that child, the most sensitive one, often becomes the symptom for the family because they're acting out some issue in the family. But that's too simple still, because that child needs to also have other things that aren't exactly where they need them to be at that stage, because usually it's pre-adolescence. Usually I hear there are commonalities to the stories I hear. It's around ages 11, 12, 10, 11, 12, 13, 10, 11, and 12, somewhere in there, that I hear that there are rumblings. What are the rumblings? The rumblings are, I feel different. I want to feel like I'm an insider.
I'm not so sure
I'm going to do well. I don't belong. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm less than. Am I less than? Could I be less than? After all, I'm thinking about middle school, and I'm frightened. I'm frightened that I'm not as good as other people. Why? Because I had experiences being teased or bullied, or because I'm changing schools. Oftentimes we'll see, and it's interesting because when you think about it, parents, when children are 10, 11, 12, are kind of at that stage where they're moving into the next level of their career development.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a decade later, so maybe they're in their mid-30s or something like that. And they're moving upward in their careers, and sometimes they're moving, physically moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so, oh, I see that over and over again, people coming in and their child
is 13. A new friends group, a new family, a new school system. And, Tina, I want you to hold that thought, because I want to talk more about that, but we do need to take a quick break. So everyone, please stay with us. Once again, we're here to take your calls. We are live, and we'll have more from Dr. Tina Gooden after a short break.
You're listening to Recovery Talk live right here on AM 600 and FM 100.3. The Answer. Feel free to call in. at 222-TALK. That's 222-8255.
News, traffic, and weather. Always informative. Keeping you connected, updated on the stories that matter. We've got you covered. AM 600 is the answer.
CBS News Update, I'm Harley Carnes. Another embarrassing weekend for the National Football League, specifically the San Francisco 49ers, with the arrest of the team's star defensive end, Ray McDonald, on felony domestic violence charges. San Jose Police Sergeant Heather Randall
conducted an investigation. They substantiated an allegation of domestic violence, and they took 49er football player Ray McDonald into custody.
He is out of jail on bail. CBS's Vladimir Duryea.
The general manager of the 49ers, Trent Baalke, responded with a statement saying that the 49ers organization is aware of the recent reports regarding Ray McDonald, and we take such matters seriously. As we continue to gather the facts, we'll reserve further comments. So they're not saying a whole lot at this point.
And the allegations come just a few days after the suspension for two games of another of the league's star players, Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice, also charged in a domestic violence dispute. CBS News Update, I'm Harley Carnes.
I'm Clayton Bromberg, the president of Underwoods. As a sixth-generation jeweler, a question I get a lot is what kind of watch do you wear? The answer's a Rolex, and there are a couple of reasons. First, when my grandfather gave me a gift for graduating from college, he said, I want you to have something that you'll always remember me for. And he gave me the Rolex watch that I wear today. Now, more than 35 years later, it still runs and looks as good as it did the day I got it. A day I'll never forget. It might be the right time for you to create the same kind of memory, and nothing does it better than a Rolex from Underwoods. Whether it's a lady's or a man's, the watch is waterproof and has the classic good looks that make Rolex the watch people want to own. And at Underwoods, all of our Rolexes carry a 5-year guarantee. So stop by Underwoods in San Marco, Avondale, the Shops of Ponte Vedra, or the Avenues Mall, and let Rolex create a memory for you.
AM 600 and FM 100.3. You want the latest traffic and weather? We've got the answer.
4:33 on your Sunday afternoon. A.J. Davis with your traffic and weather. And we've just had a report of an accident on the south side, University Boulevard southbound at Bartram Drive. There's an accident there with injuries, and there are some roadblocks, but they're not being specific, so be careful if you're heading in that area. Also, 295 at the Buckman Bridge northbound, there's been an accident there, but no roadblock reported. Also, another accident with injuries. That's in Baker County, State Road 121, just south of County Road 125 in Glen St. Mary. Also, a hit-and-run crash in the clearing stages in Clay County at U.S. 17 at County Road 220 in Orange Park. And an earlier accident has been in the clearing stages, Blanding Boulevard at Lake Gray Boulevard. That was a hit-and-run crash as well on the west side. Partly cloudy, about a 20% chance of pop-up scattered showers and thunderstorms right on through this evening. And actually start out tomorrow about the same. Mostly sunny for your Labor Day, getting better in the afternoon, with a high 93 right now, 92 degrees at AM 600 and FM 100.3.
Free talk on AM 600, The Answer. Brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. To be a part of the show, call now, 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255.
Welcome back to Recovery Talk. Again, I'm Heather Muha, Professional Outreach Representative at The Refuge. And joining me is Dr. Tina Gooden, board-certified psychologist. If you have a question for Dr. Gooden, please call us at 904-222-8255. Now, before we went to break, Dr. Gooden was educating us on how to talk to our kids about drugs and alcohol. But what if you suspect your child is already drinking or drugging? All right, Dr. Gooden, so what are some things that parents should be aware of?
So if parents notice that their child is withdrawn in a way that's different from the way it's been in the past, they're more or less keeping to themselves, they're not really wanting to engage in conversation. They're one-word answers to questions, or their grades are slipping. They're not sleeping as well as they have. They may not be eating as well. They just don't seem themselves. and, you know, you've taken them to the doctor, everything's fine, they're medically okay, and it seems to me that it's time to have a talk with your child.
What would that talk look like, Tina?
So
you're a mom.
What
does that talk look like?
Various ways. Yeah, the talk can look, it can be a gentle breaking into the inner world of the child by asking them if something is going on in their life that they want to share. And sometimes children are feeling embarrassed and feeling shame, and they're concerned that their mother or their father is going to be very, very disappointed, and they're feeling that they would be reprimanded and so on. So it's important to come alongside the child's way of looking at it, which is that they could be feeling ashamed of themselves. And so the parent does well by actually using the language of the child, what they imagine is in the child's mind, like, you know, I wonder if you're feeling a little uncomfortable right now because, you know, you're noticing mom is raising something with you that might make you feel uncomfortable. Is there something uncomfortable going on inside in your life that you don't want to share? And sometimes a child will hold their head down and just nod.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, put your arm around your child and let them know that you're with them. You're right alongside. See yourself. Imagine yourself being inside the mind of the child. Oh, so that must be really hard to talk about. Say the child's name is Jane. So, Jane, that must be so difficult to talk about. Can't imagine how it must feel to having mom, you know, even raise this with you. I'm talking to a child, let's say, 10, 11, 12.
Sure.
Raise this with you and you're uncomfortable. I can understand that. What are you uncomfortable about? And oftentimes a child will give you just a little bit more information.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, mom, there was something happened. Something happened that sounds pretty uncomfortable. What happened? Tell me about it. It's okay. It's okay. Nothing bad is going to happen. Reassure your child that nothing bad is going to happen if you share it with me. I love you. I will always love you. That's not going away. I want to be there and hear because you must be uncomfortable. And often when you say that, the child will then open up a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So as the child opens up a little bit more, you keep affirming them. And they will tell you when you do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And hopefully that line of communication, Tina, between a parent and a child happens long before they're 10, 11, and 12 and faced with some of those difficult or risky situations where they might have the choice to pick up a drink or a drug. So establishing that communication at an early age and that safety and that unconditional love, I would think would have to just be the bedrock of it all.
It is the bedrock, Heather, and that's why we can't start at 10, 11, 12. This applies to all ages, right from the beginning. If you want your child to talk with you, you know, I have mothers come to my office, and my child won't tell me. They won't tell me. How come they won't tell me? And I, you know, I wonder how they talk to their children. When the child comes in, I do hear. And so parents sometimes need a little work on learning how to enter their child's world and have their child feel comfortable, affirmed, loved, and not fearful, because at the end of the day, they are frightened and ashamed and embarrassed. And if you want them to open up, we need to sort of comfort that side and say, it's okay, I get that. I am not going to walk away, pull back. I'm not going to reprimand you. I'm not going to punish you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that drug and alcohol dependence can happen to anyone, but if there's a history of addiction, cocaine, alcohol, nicotine, drugs, whatever, in your family, then the child has a much greater risk of developing an addiction, sort of a genetic predisposition to that. And as a parent, I'd think that they'd want to be aware of this elevated risk and possibly discuss it with that child. Would you suggest that this happens? And if so, what would that conversation look like?
So I think that it's kind of like learning about the birds and the bees, you know. there are books and there's media and then there's the conversations that parents have with their children. And they kind of apprise them of it in the sense that they want them to know something about the world out there, and this exists, and, you know, it may be someone in the family has had this, or, you know, it's possible, you never know, so we need to, and so you raise the topic as a topic. It is a topic, it's a legitimate topic to, it, just the way you would raise anything else with your child, and it's not because you're saying that they're going to have this happen to them, it's not because you're saying it is happening in the family, it's because it's learning about the world out there. It's no different than, you know, how you teach children to learn how to play with kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, and who to choose to be your friends. You model it, you demonstrate it, and you talk about it, and you make sure that your actions support what you say. It's not as if you're just words. It's that you actually walk the talk. So you can broach these topics. It becomes household topics. You know, it becomes easy to talk about once you start early, you talk. That's what certain families are into, sharing feelings. And so
that's a novel idea, Tina.
Yeah, that's
family
the whole idea.
Family sharing feelings, wow.
Yeah, it's not difficult when you have that kind of an environment.
Yes, I wouldn't think so. And, I mean, I remember the media campaigns back in the 80s. It was just say no. And now sometimes you hear about parents saying, drink responsibly. Give me your keys, but you can drink in my house. Well, you can try it, but be careful, or you're going to try it. This is what's going to happen. Any advice on which one of those popular slogans it seems to work, or is it a case-by-case basis where you say just say no to drugs, it's a done deal, it's black and white, it's not going to happen, it's not tolerated in my household?
It's interesting, that's a good question. You know, I think when I look at the numbers of people I've seen, there are families that will allow it, if it's partially allow it, you know, do it under my roof, and then there are those families that it's just not going to happen.
Right.
And it's not part of their values. It's not part of their culture. It never was, and it never will be. In that way, often it is pretty black and white. So that brings us back to the first, you know, the other topic, which is that if the other conditions are met, meaning that there's an open environment, people talk, but that doesn't guarantee anything. But I do see people whose families, they just, that's not part of their culture. It doesn't matter if it's in front of them. It's never going to happen anyways.
Right.
And so I would say more often than not, when someone comes to my office and they have tried it, there's somebody in the family who's tried it before them. There's somebody close to them who's tried it before them. And if not, there's something going on in the dynamics in the family.
I see. So there's more than just as simple as just say no, drink responsibly, or
much
it's not
more
part of the volume. Okay. Well, let's talk more about that. We do have to take a break as well. We have a few more minutes left in the show, so if you, our listeners out there, have a question for Dr. Gooden, now is the time to give us a call. You can reach us at 904-222-8255, and we'll be right back with more Recovery Talk.
You're listening to Recovery Talk live. That's right, it's a live show today on this Sunday afternoon. Call in at 222-TALK. That's 222-8255. We'll be back to Recovery Talk in about 60 seconds.
The Refuge, a healing place, is a leading treatment program for men and women struggling with addictions, trauma, and co-occurring issues such as depression. The Refuge is nationally renowned for working with its clients to create real, long-term recovery. With their caring staff, you begin to unravel the underlying causes of your issues and gain the strength to accept and overcome them. They take a unique trauma-aware approach to treating addiction and co-occurring issues that emphasizes holistic treatment of the mind, body, and spirit. Their safe private campus is located an hour north of Orlando in Ocala, Florida, and features residential and outpatient treatment as well as drug detox. You can call them for a free confidential consultation, 866-612-6610, or visit their website, therefuge-ahealingplace.com. Welcome back to Recovery Talk on AM 600, The Answer, brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. To be a part of the show, call now, 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255.
Hello and welcome back to Recovery Talk. I'm Heather Muha, professional outreach representative for The Refuge. And joining me is Dr. Tina Gooden, board-certified psychologist. Tina, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and insight with us as we tackle the difficult topic or conversation of talking with kids all ages about the dangers of drugs and alcohol. And it seems that all the questions you've answered have come down to one very, very simple point, which is it's never about, or it's not about the drugs and alcohol. It is so much more of what is underlying and what is going on in that situation that would cause that child, teenager, adult, what have you, to look toward drugs and alcohol as a solution to something else that's happening. Would you say that summary is correct?
Oh, yes, it's right on, Heather. You know, drugs and alcohol is the symptom, and it could just as easily be an eating issue, or it could be anything else. And so we always want to look to the underlying issues that help us to understand why that was, what led to it. And so when we clear up the underlying issues, and we do clear them up, this isn't just about looking to the past and saying, oh, you know, we have to go back to the past and, you know, well, what's there to look at in the past? We can't redo it. Well, yes. In fact, we can learn so much from that past in the present for our future so that our future doesn't carry the conflict from the past, and so there's no need for the symptom, i.e. alcohol or drugs. And so, yes, I think the basis for most every symptom is what we need to really clean up. And when we do that, we pretty well are assured of action going forward that is under the heading of better choices.
Do you often have parents that just say, fix my child? We're just going to drop them off, and I just want to make sure they're fixed. How do you encourage parents' participation?
I do my little thing. You know, this is radio. When I do television, it's sort of they come in and they bring the child and they say, you know, I motion to the ear. They're holding the child by the ear and going, here's Johnny. Fix him. I'm going
fix
shopping.
Johnny.
Yeah.
That's going to happen.
The truth of the matter is that I need that parent in the office to fix Johnny.
Yeah.
And why? Because, you know, the families matter. I mean, every member of the family is part of why Johnny is symptomatic. And, you know, that's the trick in doing the family work, where every member of the family is able to finally, at long last, assume responsibility for their role. They're not mean. They didn't intend to cause harm. It's part of dynamics. We unconsciously, we unconsciously direct our communication so that there is always a scapegoat in the family.
Mm.
And it's part of taking the responsibility that belongs to us off our shoulders and get rid of it. I mean, the blame game, isn't that what it's, you know, that's what everybody's worried about. And so that's why the family work needs to revolve around that we don't lay blame. Everyone has roles. And so it's not about blame. It's about stepping up and taking a look together at what your roles are in the family, each and every member of the family. And sooner or later, we get to see that we I do this kind of on a board, actually, where I'm able to show all the pairs and triangles in one little family where dynamics are flying around. There's usually one person who, you know, kind of gets what they want more often than the other, and the other one's saying, well, how come so-and-so always gets what they want, and why does one parent take the side of that child and not the other? And parents are quick to say, well, I love all my children equally, and I treat them all the same. That couldn't be that's the furthest thing from the truth. Parents do not treat every single child in their family the same. They have particular ways of being with each of their children. And the children absorb that and they identify with it. They actually play the role that the parent sort of put them in.
Mm.
So if the parent puts the child in the role of being the people pleaser and the child tends to be a people pleaser type, they can collude with one another and the child will be the people pleaser for that parent.
And you say the people pleasers are also more so at risk for picking up that drink or that drug.
Yes, certainly not all.
Right.
You know, we always need a convergence of factors that make for something to happen. It could be something genetic, but we need more than it's not as if all people pleasers end up doing drugs.
Right.
But yes, yeah, but it is a very prominent feature, I would say.
Interesting. And you said also, so for parents that are sitting at home listening to us and they're looking at their family and they're looking at their kids and they're saying, oh, I think that I might have identified some of those traits that Dr. Tina Gooden had mentioned in terms of my child is withdrawing a bit. Well, grades are slipping a little bit, but he or she did just change schools, or Johnny seems to want to do everything to please the family or make everyone else happy. All of those things, what steps can that parent take right now just to kind of get the ball rolling to perhaps prevent future problems?
Mm-hmm. Sit down with your child. Have a frank talk, a loving frank talk. No fear, no threats, no punishment, more like, I was a kid too, you know, and I know that when I was kind of like 13 years old, I thought about doing some things I could never do when I was 7. Is there anything going on? And, you know, oftentimes your child will then begin to open up. I think keeping those lines of communication open at all times. Have that talk with both parents, mother and father, with that child. Also, talk with your children's friends together with your child, and you know, you can kind of have a little group thing going with the family, you know, your child and a couple of their friends, and talk about what's going on. You'd be surprised, one of the friends might say something that your child might not have told you, and so that gives you another opportunity to get inside their heads, which is the point. Go to the schools, talk to the teachers, talk to the parents of your children's friends. See if, you know, make sure that you know what's going on as much as possible, what's going on in their homes too, because your child, after all, is hanging out with that friend. So if they're doing after school activities, ask who's in the classes and see if there's anything going on with anybody in any of those after school activities. Most important though, make sure that you give your child the feeling that they are loved, there's nothing to fear, there's nothing to be ashamed of, because there isn't. Because you're there to help them navigate through the kinds of things in life that sometimes can feel awful inside. And you too are a person, and you too grew up, and you too struggle with things on a daily basis. Your child will always appreciate hearing that you are a person. As well,
yes,
as a
and
parent.
Human, yes, and struggle, and that doesn't necessarily
and
mean
struggle.
That you are weak.
Yeah. No, It's not a sign of weakness, and that's an important point. I'm glad you put it in that way. You know, it's a sign of strength to be able to open up. Look, I, as your mom, can open up. I had things happen to me when I was your age, and there's always something. So, you know, I want us to be able to talk about them together with me as, you know, kind of I was once a little girl, too. Let's talk together.
Sure. And really quickly, we only have a couple more minutes, Tina, but what if that child does come, looks you in the eye and says, well, I smoked pot last weekend, or my friends are doing drugs and I did it too. In that moment, in that time, in that reaction, or what if you've caught your child, your teenager doing drugs or alcohol, what sort of reaction or what advice could you give parents at that point?
Well, I think the very first reaction inside of a parent is panic.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one is shame, their own shame, that they failed as a parent. So, or they might both be the number one feeling. And I think parents can be overwhelmed, and often their first reaction is not wonderful for their child because they come at it more reprimanding than they do understanding. And so I think the parent needs to take time out. I think the parent needs to take a few minutes, whatever they need, an hour a day, to sit back and reflect. And then when they get themselves together, come back and join the child in on the subject, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, to start talking about what would have led them to want to do that. How did it come about? What were they feeling? What were they thinking? What did they think of the experience? Would they consider doing it again? And do they think that this is something that they would like to have in their life? And why would they and why wouldn't they? And try to put the judgment to the side, because as soon as the children hear the judgment, they're frightened. They think they're bad, and then they will pull away. They will be defensive and pull away. And we don't want that. So try to keep the judgment in another room and be an ear, someone who that the child can tell you what was on their mind. They failed some tests they didn't tell you about, they were afraid to tell you about, they thought that you weren't going to be happy with them, that they were going to be letting you down, and they would have, well, maybe that is going on. Maybe the expectations of that parent are just too great for the child at this time in their life.
Right, but again, that would open up the lines of communication.
Exactly, exactly. And so was
child,
that a way to cope with it, with a drug?
No, not at all. Well, Tina, I don't mean to cut you off. We do have to end the show, though, and I just want to thank you so much for taking the time off in your Labor Day weekend to be with us and to deal with a very, very important topic for our parents as their kids go back to school. And, thanks for being with us, Tina.
Yeah. Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it as well.
And I also wanted to thank Mark Rosen, who was a case manager with The Refuge. He was on earlier in the show and teaching us all about what case management means to our clients and how they can help them through treatment. If you yourself are looking for help or for someone you know, The Refuge, we have counselors available right now for a confidential telephone conversation or consultation. You can call The Refuge, 877-762-1811.
Or a family member, you can call 866-612-6610. 866-612-6610.